content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 22nd, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is set at a poker table. There's a man, a military man, facing us. I believe this is Ahmad Vahidi, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard in Iran. Over his shoulder on the wall is hanging a portrait of the Ayatollah. There are poker chips on the table, and he's actually holding his poker hand, showing the viewer. And he has a royal flush in clubs, stern look on his face. The headline is, "Who Holds the Cards? Why Iran Won't Accept Trump's Terms." And that is our second main story. I believe we will do both of the main stories today. First up, GOP notches more victories in redistricting fight. What happened? Democrats were left scrambling this week after a back-to-back set of redistricting losses narrowed their odds of taking back the House in November, with Supreme Court clearing the way for Alabama Republicans to redraw the state's electoral map and Virginia's high court throwing out a Democratic map designed to flip red House seats blue. The ruling by the Supreme Court's conservative majority could allow the Alabama legislature to use a 2023 voting map that eliminates one of the state's two majority black districts, both of which are currently held by Democrats. A lower court had blocked that map on the grounds that it violated Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which bars racial discrimination in voting. But the high court's conservative justices said that decision should be reconsidered in light of last month's Louisiana versus Calais, in which the court found the creation of majority black districts to be an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. In the Louisiana legislature, a Senate committee passed a congressional map that will eliminate one of two majority black districts, while in Tennessee, Governor Bill Lee signed into law a new congressional map that carves up the state's sole Democratic-held district, based in majority black Memphis. "It's unbelievable how people seem to want to turn things backward," said Barbara Love, a black woman who lives outside Memphis. In Virginia, the state's top court reversed a new electoral map approved by voters in a ballot measure in April, which was designed to flip four Republican-held House seats. The court ruled 4-3 that Democratic lawmakers had violated a procedural mandate by rushing to pass the redistricting before November's midterms. State Democrats said the ruling amounted to judicial defiance of voters' will and appealed to the Supreme Court. In a rare setback for President Trump, who has urged red state legislatures to redraw maps, Republicans in South Carolina rejected a redistricting plan designed to eliminate the state's sole Democratic-held House seat. State Senate Majority Leader A. Shane Massey said carving up the district, held for 34 years by influential Representative James Clyburn, could backfire by diluting GOP support in other districts. He also warned that the current redistricting wars may anger voters. "Too many people in power," Massey said, "just want to do whatever it takes to stay in power." What the editorial said: "America's re-gerrymandering arms race is here," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "And you can thank President Trump. The seed was planted last year when Trump demanded Texas and other red states rip up their maps mid-decade to boost Republicans' midterm edge, a practice previously unheard of. That left Democrats in California, Virginia, and elsewhere not only justified in following suit, but virtually obligated to. Having state maps constantly redrawn to favor the party in power is intolerable to democracy. but that's what we face until Congress steps in to impose uniform redistricting standards. Pardon us while we revel in the comeuppance of Virginia Democrats, said National Review. With their lavishly funded referendum, they rammed through an absurdly lopsided map that stood to boost their House seat edge in the purplish state from 6-5 to 10-1. But state law dictates that any referendum to amend the Constitution must be passed twice, with a general election in between. The first vote came late in October 2025, after some 1.3 million early ballots had already been cast for the November election. The High Court's ruling that Democrats violated the letter and spirit of the law isn't even a close call. What the columnist said: the blitz to disenfranchise black Southern voters is more than a tragedy for voting rights, said Paul Waldman in public notice. It's a virtual revival of the Confederacy. Even as aggrieved white Republicans have revived Confederate symbols, ended diversity initiatives, and otherwise tried to walk back the civil rights movement, progressives have held faith that their foes were fighting a doomed rearguard action. But it's now clear that the right never lost its own faith, that with enough determination, the 1960s could be undone, and maybe some of the 1860s as well. Such hooey makes it sound like Republicans are demanding literacy tests at voting precincts, said Barton Swain in the Wall Street Journal. What they're combating, and what the Supreme Court rightly ended, is the practice of packing black voters into districts designed to advantage one party. Democrats can gussy it up with lofty talk of vote dilution, but the ugly fact is that such districts divide voters according to skin color. The GOP's strong-arming could backfire badly, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. Yes, it will boost the party in the short term, but New York, Colorado, Maryland, and other blue states could well turn the tables and rub out Republican districts. Lawmakers in many of those states are constrained by legal and structural barriers that prevent mid-decade gerrymandering. But they can be undone, and Democrats will be under enormous pressure to fight fire with fire. This is getting dangerous, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. The redistricting rush will push American politics to an even more dangerous place of high partisan tension and ideological balkanization, where the House looks something like the Electoral College, a system in which a party can eke out control of a state capital and then redraw congressional maps to lock themselves in power, is not a democracy in any meaningful sense. But that seems to be where the United States is headed, if it's not already there. And our second main story. Trump says Iran ceasefire on life support. What happened? President Trump this week rejected what he calls Tehran's garbage proposal to end the U.S.-Iran war and threatened to renew hostilities as the effects of Iran's shuttering of the Strait of Hormuz grew more painful for Americans. In response to a U.S. proposal, Tehran reportedly demanded sanctions relief, an end to Washington's naval blockade of its ports, where both sides exchanged fire last week, and a permanent halt to fighting in Lebanon. But Trump said he didn't even finish reading the 14-point plan. The ceasefire is on massive life support, he said. The comments further rattled energy markets. While U.S. gasoline prices this week climbed over $4.50 a gallon on average, Trump proposed suspending the federal gas tax to ease prices, but the idea received a tepid response from Congress. When asked about America's worsening financial struggles, Trump said he wasn't concerned. The only thing that matters when I'm talking about Iran, they can't have a nuclear weapon. Despite Trump promising to finish the job if Iran doesn't meet that demand, Tehran appeared defiant. Our armed forces are ready to deliver a lesson-teaching response to any act of aggression, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, the Speaker of Iranian Parliament and a lead negotiator, wrote on social media. Classified U.S. intelligence reports suggest that Iran retains significant missile capabilities and has regained access to 30 of 33 missile sites along Hormuz, the New York Times reported. That contrasts sharply with the Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's claims that the U.S. has shattered Iran's military in a conflict the Pentagon said has already cost more than $29 billion. The war loomed over Trump's visit to China this week, where the president said he expected to have a long talk about it with his counterpart, Xi Jinping. What the columnist said, Iran clearly thinks Trump is bluffing about launching a new round of strikes, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. And why shouldn't they? They've spent the last week trashing the ceasefire, twice attacking U.S. warships with missiles, drones, and speedboats, and repeatedly firing on the United Arab Emirates, a U.S. ally. The U.S. responded, in Trump's own words, with a mere love tap. This commitment to a failed ceasefire reeks of a president who no longer wants the fight. Trump has misunderstood the Iranians from the beginning, said Rich Lowry in National Review. He thought he could swoop in and dominate them militarily, at which point rational interlocutors, akin to the construction contractors he dealt with hundreds of times in the course of building a tower or golf course, would emerge and strike a deal. But the Islamic Republic is not fundamentally transactional. It is profoundly serious ideological project grounded in Shia Islam, run by hardliners like Ahmad Vahidi, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Never underestimate an enemy with a fanatical will. Don't underestimate the frustrations of American voters either, said Paul Waldman in his Substack newsletter. Inflation, driven by rising energy cost, increased 3.8% in the U.S. in April, the largest spike in 3 years. Trump's best idea to fix this self-inflicted wound? An idiotic national gas tax holiday that will go nowhere in Congress. And even if it did, it would save Americans a paltry 18.4 cents per gallon at the pump. The proposal just makes Trump look even more out of touch and indifferent to people's struggles. That's partly why this rushed, chaotic war is so unpopular, said Mike Nelson in the Dispatch. Polls show that 60% of Americans oppose the operation, and only 19% believe it's been successful. But Trump still has time to shed his intemperate, impulsive, and injudicious strategy and embrace a clear-eyed plan that curbs Iran's nuclear ambitions and prevents the truly catastrophic outcome of an obvious American defeat. Except at this point, said Robert Kagan in The Atlantic, any resolution other than America's effective surrender holds enormous risks that Trump hasn't shown he is willing to take. Convoying tankers through a contested strait risked the loss of American warships. A new round of airstrikes would spark Iranian retaliation, causing devastating long-term damage to the Gulf's productive capabilities. And an attempt to finally topple the Iranian regime would require a full-scale ground and naval invasion and subsequent occupation. Walking away now has its own consequences. Iran will maintain control of the strait, and Israel's interest will be threatened. But it might be the least bad option Trump has. If this isn't checkmate, it's close. The controversy of the week, hantavirus. Are we ready for another pandemic? No one should panic, but this is certainly a worrying chain of events, said Tara C. Smith in MS.now. Last week, news broke that three people aboard the Dutch cruise ship MV Hondius had died of suspected hantavirus. a respiratory disease with no cure or vaccine. The Hondius was eventually allowed to dock in Tenerife, Spain, but before the pathogen was identified, some 30 passengers had disembarked and flown home to 12 countries, potentially seeding the planet with a virus that kills 38% of its victims. A six-week incubation period means we don't yet know the extent of the outbreak, but at least eight other Hondius-linked infections have been confirmed, and 18 Americans are being monitored, two at containment facilities in Atlanta, one of those passengers is symptomatic, and 16 in Nebraska. I hope it's fine, said President Trump. But Trump also hoped it would be fine in February 2020, when passengers on another ship, the Diamond Princess, started dying from COVID-19. And back then, we were still part of the World Health Organization. Trump ordered the U.S. out last year, and conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wasn't our health secretary. We are in the hands of madmen now, said Charles P. Pearson, Esquire. An outbreak of any disease more serious than COVID in this country is in a world of hurt. The story is certainly tragic, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. The first two fatalities, a Dutch couple, were probably infected through exposure to rat droppings while bird watching in Argentina. But this likely isn't the opening scene for a bigger, scarier movie. The human transmissible strain of hantavirus is not very infectious, requiring prolonged contact with someone already suffering symptoms. Standard public health measures have contained previous outbreaks, the worst being a 2018 outbreak in Epuyén, Argentina, in which 11 died. Experts say there's little reason to fear the new cluster will turn into anything bigger. Which experts, asked Zeynep Tufekci in the New York Times. Microbiologist Gustavo Palacios, who studied the Epuyén outbreak, is baffled by these reassurances. In Epuyén, a single guest at a birthday party infected five others in 90 minutes, and the widow of one victim infected 10 more people at his wake. These super-spreader events suggest the virus could spark a pandemic. We may have been spared in 2018 because Epuyén is an isolated rural village in Patagonia. The 2026 Hondius outbreak, by contrast, has already gone global, and, as with the early days of COVID, global health leaders are erring on the side of reassurance rather than sharing accurately and loudly what little we know about this terrifying virus. In the U.S., the response has been sluggish, said Apoorva Mandavili, also in the Times. It took a week after WHO formally confirmed the hantavirus infections for the administration to hold its first briefing, and a month after the first death to set up a CDC task force. Hollowed out by Trump and Kennedy, our health agencies aren't remotely ready for another pandemic, said Katrine Wallace in Stat News. Not so our post-COVID infrastructure of misinformation. That network of influencers, conspiracy accounts, and partisan personalities, they're already spinning this outbreak as further proof that scientists are corrupt, vaccines are the real threat, and hawking ivermectin from the link of their bio. It's this new infrastructure, along with Trump's vandalism of the old one, that will hurt us the most should another pandemic arrive. And one will. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for practical exams. After six EMT students at Wisconsin's Fox Valley Technical College saved the life of their instructor, who went into cardiac arrest while playing the patient in a simulated heart attack exercise. Instructor Carl Arps, who underwent triple bypass surgery, said he often wondered if his students listened during lessons. Well, now I know. It's a good week for gratitude. After 6 foot thank you, President Trump banners, featuring a photo of the president in a hard hat, appeared at construction sites across Washington. An Interior Department spokesman said the administration was proud to recognize Trump's improvements to the Capitol. It was a good week for Aussie pluck. After some 400 swimmers competed in Western Australia's annual Lake Argyle Swim, a day after a freshwater crocodile attacked four people in the same lake. It maybe gave them a bit of motivation to swim faster, said the secretary of the Darwin Swimming Club. But it was a bad week for toil. After Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced he'd spent the past 7 months driving across the country with his family, filming a Trump-approved reality show. The Real World alum reassured Americans that during the road trip, we just kind of found these moments where I might be able to do some work. It's a bad week for facial recognition. After a survey of UK children found that a third had bypassed online age verification checks in the past 2 months, some by drawing mustaches on their faces with eyebrow pencils. Finally, it was a bad week for Brave New Worlds after a University of Central Florida commencement speaker earned boos from new grads after declaring artificial intelligence to be the next industrial revolution. When a later remark that only a few years ago AI was not a factor in our lives earned cheers, real estate exec Gloria Caulfield ad-libbed that, "I see we have a bipolar topic here." On to the briefing, title this week, A Dangerous High. The U.S. is being flooded with synthetic drugs that are cheap to make, hard to track, and fraught with risk. Are synthetic drugs new? Lab-made or designer drugs have been around for decades. LSD is synthetic, and so is methamphetamine. But what's new is the dizzying scale and variety of synthetic intoxicants and their increasing dominance of the drug market. Traditionally, most illicit drugs have come from plants that are cultivated on a large scale, such as marijuana, opium and heroin from poppies, and cocaine from coca leaves. But those plant-based drugs are being supplanted or adulterated by synthetic stimulants, opioids, and cannabinoids made in clandestine labs that are far cheaper and easier for traffickers to produce and transport. They're also far deadlier. Some 80,400 Americans died of drug overdoses in 2024, nearly 70% more than a decade earlier. Synthetic opioids, mainly fentanyl, accounted for nearly 68% of those deaths. Fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin, is now giving way to even deadlier compounds such as the 10 times more powerful cyclophosphamine. In Knoxville, Tennessee, a national cyclophosphamine hotspot, at least 50 overdoses involving the drug have been confirmed in the past 6 months. This is the modern drug epidemic, said Bob DuPont, U.S. drug czar under Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. It's like nothing that's happened in the world before. Anywhere. How many synthetic drugs are there? More than 1,460 new psychoactive substances have been recorded by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime since 2013, tripling in just over a decade. And new compounds are popping up with staggering speed, leaving law enforcement scrambling to keep up. Once a month or every other month, we're encountering something that we've never seen before, said Ed Sisko, a research chemist who tracks street drugs for the federal government. One reason traffickers keep inventing new drugs is to stay ahead of the law. The moment a compound is identified and made illegal, narcochemists, sometimes aided by artificial intelligence, tweak its molecular structure to get around the law. Each time we get rid of one substance, said forensic scientist Alex Kratulski, they come up with something more potent. What are these new drugs? They run the gamut. There are sedatives such as xylazine, street named Trank, an animal tranquilizer that can cause flesh-rotting skin lesions and is frequently mixed with fentanyl. Last month, the CDC warned about the rise of metatomidine, or rhinotranq, which is up to 200 times more potent and doesn't respond to conventional overdose reversal treatments like naloxone. There are hundreds of synthetic cannabinoids, such as K2 and Spice, sold at smoke shops and convenience stores across the U.S. They can yield a weed-like high. It could also cause agitation, delusion, seizures, kidney damage, and in extreme cases, death. There are cathinones, stimulants modeled on MDMA that hijack the dopamine system in the brain and thus are extremely addictive, said Michael Bauman of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. There's a reason why chemists would design these. Nitazenes are an even bigger category. What are nitazenes? Developed as painkillers in the 1950s, this family of synthetic opioids was never approved for clinical use because of its staggering potencies. Some nitazenes are so powerful that under 2 milligrams, the equivalent of a few grains of sand, can kill a person by shutting down breathing. Since they surfaced in the U.S. in 2019, the drugs have caused at least 2,000 overdose deaths. The newest worry is a different class of synthetic opioids called orphines, which include cyclorphine. Joe Guy, sheriff in McMinn County, Tennessee, an hour south of Knoxville, notes one issue common among synthetic drugs: wildly varying potency that makes ingestion a crapshot. One pill, one hit, can literally end your life, said Guy. And because traffickers often use cheap new synthetics to boost narcotics such as fentanyl and heroin, or even substitute them for various pills, drug consumers very often don't even know what they are taking. Authorities in Arkansas last week confirmed the state's first known cyclorphine death, an unidentified man who took what he thought was an oxycodone pill, which was actually laced with the more powerful orphine. This is mass-produced deception, said Ted Brown, head of the Arkansas Crime Laboratory. Where are these drugs coming from? The federal government pegs the primary source as Mexican cartels using chemicals sourced from China. Other synthetic drugs come directly from China and sometimes India and are cut and sold by small domestic operators. Efforts have been made to stem the flow of raw materials, but with unintended consequences. When China tightened controls on chemicals used in fentanyl in 2019, narcochemists researched alternatives and revived production of nitazenes. Last summer, China banned nitazenes, which may have led to the sudden rise of cyclorphine. Is there a better way to respond? On the street level, there are calls for wider distribution of naloxone and for educating young people about the dangers that may lurk inside a pain pill or a bag of synthetic cannabinoids. On the enforcement front, there are moves to increase global cooperation to disrupt supply chains, stem trafficking, and identify emerging threats. To that end, the Biden administration in July 2023 launched the 160-nation Global Coalition to address synthetic drug threats. China has not yet joined the group, but some experts emphasize that the era of synthetic drugs underlines the need to address the root factors that make users seek out drugs, given the futility of targeting a supply that's constantly expanding and shifting. Today is the most dangerous time in the history of the world to be using drugs, said Andrew Monte, who runs the Rocky Mountain Poison Center. That's until tomorrow, when there's a new drug. Time for a few of the best columns First up is the folly of the Abraham Accords. President Trump's Abraham Accords were based on a fantasy, said Matthew Duss and Zuri Lenetsky. The 2020 pact normalizing ties between Israel and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, and later Morocco and Sudan, was sold as a framework for delivering regional peace and stability. But 6 years on, it's clear the policy actually laid the groundwork for a new era of violence. The agreement rewarded Arab nations for joining an alliance with Israel by letting them buy sophisticated U.S. weapons and creating an overarching anti-Iran missile and drone defense system. Muting the Gulf states' criticism of Israel served as a way to permanently marginalize the Palestinians. Hamas' October 7th massacre of Israelis was an attempt to disrupt this new alliance. But the Gulf states looked the other way as an increasingly hegemonic Israel carried out genocide in Gaza. The subsequent reckless war against Iran became possible because the Accords created false confidence that the joint anti-missile defense system would thwart Iranian missiles and drones. The Accords also promoted the illusion that both the Palestinian and Iranian problems could be easily fixed. Instead, we now have less security and more war. Worshipping the Golden Trump. During his 2016 campaign, said William Crystal, President Trump ran on the slogan, "I'm with you." It seemed ridiculous for this selfish and self-centered con man to present himself as being for you, the people, but somehow he pulled it off. Not once, but again in 2024. In his second term, the aging demagogue is no longer disguising his insatiable narcissism. Last week, Trump's Florida golf course unveiled a 22-foot-tall bronze statue of the Dear Leader, covered in shiny gold leaf. Right-wing pastor Mark Burns, who serves as Trump's spiritual advisor, blessed the statue, defending his idolatry of the MAGA king by saying, "Let me be clear, this is not a golden calf." But he surely doth protest too much. A preening Trump boasted about the love of fawning followers who came to pay tribute to this glittering monument to his ego. Trump's vanity is also fueling his plan to build a massive gilded triumphal arch directly in front of Arlington National Cemetery, a grotesque intrusion of one of our most sacred public spaces. For years, Trump fooled millions of Americans into thinking he cared about them, but the truth is now unavoidable. Trump is for himself. This column comes from South Africa. Falling into a Chinese trap. China sure looks generous, said Anthony Ohomeng Boma. This month, it lowered tariffs to zero for nearly every African country. This expands a sweetheart deal Beijing extended in December 2024 to the 33 least developed African countries. The temptation is to celebrate. The zero tariffs apply to exports from crops to minerals to manufactured goods, no strings attached. It's refreshingly uncomplicated in an era when the U.S. president is hiking levies on everyone who won't bargain away their critical minerals. But China's trade policy isn't a ticket to instant African prosperity. If the Chinese economy slows, the windfall could evaporate overnight. Diversified as his dismantling of democratic checks and balances, and he painted us as enemies of the state. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that Trump is rewarding him. Chavez sucked up to the U.S. president at every opportunity. He banned China's Huawei and took in hundreds of U.S. deportees from many nations. We journalists do not seek to portray ourselves as martyrs or heroes, but we're putting the enemies of free expression on notice. We will continue reporting without fear. Allowing would-be autocrats here or abroad to silence free speech would undermine the integrity of our democracy. Time for the last word, our feature article. The next Cold War. As great powers tussle for control of the Arctic, said Greg Jaffe in the New York Times, U.S. soldiers from places like Georgia, Florida, and Texas are learning how to fight and survive in the freezing north. Fort Wainwright, Alaska. The soldiers heaved the 300-pound plastic sleds down the hallway of their headquarters building. Packed inside were the things they would need to survive when the temperature at their Alaska training area plunged to 40 below zero or colder. Each sled carried a tent with enough room for 10 soldiers if they curled their legs. There were gasoline containers to fuel a small metal stove that would keep them warm. There were shovels to clear the snow and hammers, stakes, and rope to keep their tents standing when the winds howled. There were fire extinguishers in case the whole thing caught ablaze. Make room, the soldiers screamed. The white sled screeched across the linoleum floor. In Washington and other capitals around the world, the Arctic is cast as a new frontier for military competition, a region where rising temperatures are opening new sea lanes and creating new access to valuable rare earth minerals. Pentagon strategy papers have repeatedly called for closer cooperation with Arctic allies and the construction of new bases to ward off rivals like Russia and China. President Donald Trump has expressed his interest in more atavistic terms, vowing to buy or, if necessary, conquer Greenland by force. I would like to make a deal the easy way, Trump said this year of his ambitions for the semi-autonomous Danish territory. But if we don't do it the easy way, we're going to do it the hard way. Absent from all the strategy documents and Oval Office threats is any sense of how U.S. troops might fight in the brutal conditions. At the Yukon Training Center, a 400-mile expanse of snow and ice near Fairbanks, Alaska, in the Arctic Circle, the Army was preparing for a new kind of war. At minus 40 degrees and below, weapons fail, batteries quickly lose their charge, and fuel turns into a viscous jelly. Army officials wanted to learn how their equipment would perform in the extreme cold. But their biggest questions were about the soldiers who came from places like Alabama, Texas, Florida, and California. How far could these troops go before exhaustion set in and they started to lose focus, make mistakes, or simply quit? About 4,000 soldiers from the Army's 11th Airborne Division, including 107 from the division's Able Company, were taking part in the training battle, which pitted two similarly sized forces against each other. In this fight, the ammunition was fake. Blanks and lasers replaced bullets and artillery shells, but the cold was unsparingly real. Captain Trung Duan Vo had been in command of Able Company for almost a year, enough time to understand the dangers his soldiers faced from frostbite. The coldest nights, he knew, could take their fingers and toes. If soldiers got sloppy, it could cost them their lives. He called the company's leaders together inside their small headquarters to update them on the latest intelligence on the enemy, which consisted of about 1,000 paratroopers along two ridgelines. Outside, it was a relatively balmy minus 3 degrees. A light snow was falling. Bo's most immediate worry was the company's movement across a frozen river into the training area and the possibility that someone might break through the ice. He stressed the importance of quickly alerting him and the other leaders to real-world issues like frostbite and hypothermia. Heads nodded. "The Arctic always puts a little fear into me as a leader," Bo confessed. "If you don't do the right things, you will die." The Able Company soldiers said they often felt as if they were participants in a big experiment. Some had volunteered to serve in Alaska in search of adventure or because the Army had offered them a cash bonus. Others were there purely by chance. Someone in the Pentagon's vast bureaucracy needed to fill an open spot in an infantry platoon. The troops climbed off the buses and spent the next several hours searching for their rucksacks and other equipment in the dark. The soldiers knew they were at higher risk for frostbite and other weather-related injuries when they were not moving, so they flapped their arms and stomped their feet to keep their blood flowing. If you're cold, put on your level sevens, a sergeant screamed, referring to their heaviest jackets. Vo expected that his company's lead element, about two dozen troops from its first platoon, would push across the frozen river and march 3 miles through knee-deep snow with their tents and equipment. Around 2 a.m., Vo's lieutenant and first sergeant quietly approached. The 10-day exercise had barely begun, and some of the troops already looked miserable. The snowfall was growing heavier. The lieutenant and first sergeant suggested that they modify the plan and cut the first platoon's movement that night down to 1 mile. Vo's normally upbeat demeanor shifted quickly to disgust. "I'm so sick of whiny infantrymen," he yelled. Vo was a relative newcomer to Alaska and still learning how to fight and survive in the extreme cold. His uncertainty about his new environment, though, was balanced against a powerful belief in the human capacity to endure difficult things, he said. As a child, he endured 6 years in a Malaysian refugee camp. Hundreds of displaced Vietnamese families, including his own, were packed into a space not much larger than a football field. Eventually, his family was granted political asylum and a new chance at life in the Atlanta suburbs, where they opened a nail salon. Now he was a 35-year-old Army officer who needed to get his company motivated and moving. "It's day one, and you already sound like you're tired," he shouted. A string of profanities followed, along with a shared understanding that the 1st Platoon soldiers were going to march the full 3 miles as planned through the snow before they broke for the night and set up their tents. By 2:24 a.m., the soldiers had strapped their snowshoes to their boots, bent under the weight of their 60-pound rucksacks. They made their way across the frozen river and disappeared into the darkness. They arrived at their objective as the sun was rising and started digging out a clearing in the snow to put up their tents. After about 30 minutes of shoveling in search of solid permafrost, they realized they were digging in frozen muskeg, a deep bog common to the Alaska wilderness. Instead of looking for a better spot, they decided to temporarily lay out their sleeping bags in the open snow. They squeezed each other's fingertips and earlobes, a regular check to ensure that blood was still flowing through their capillaries and they were not at risk for frostbite. They boiled water using portable gas heaters and poured it into plastic bottles that they stuffed into their sleeping bags for extra warmth. After a couple hours in their cold bags, they resumed their search for solid ground. Vo arrived just as they were scraping the permafrost and staking their tents. "You look demoralized," he told 1st Lieutenant Jordan Lofgren, the platoon leader. "That was an ass kick," replied Lofgren, 26. "Without some rest, we can't move the way we just did." The platoon had about 6 hours before they would have to head out again. Senior leaders knew that their frontline troops cared about two things more than anything else. They want to know when they are going to get warm, and they want to know when they are going to eat their next hot meal, said Colonel Christopher Brawley, who oversaw about 2,700 troops, including Vo's Able Company. Brawley built his strategy around this harsh reality. If he could cut off the enemy's access to food and fuel, Brawley believed that he could rapidly break their will to fight. The Able Company troops were part of a big force moving to cut off the enemy's northern supply routes. A smaller force, made up of several hundred Canadian soldiers, was pushing across more than 10 miles of heavy snow and muskeg, a multi-day slog to close off the harder-to-reach southern routes. "The Canadians have a horrifying task," Brawley said, "but they also had some advantages. They had three times as many snowmobiles as the U.S. battalions in the Arctic. Their soldiers were accustomed to operating in the extreme cold." As the Canadians drove south, Vo and his troops trudged toward their objectives in the north. The days blurred together. The troops longed for the moment when they would sneak up on the enemy and test their soldier skills in a simulated firefight with lasers, smoke, and the loud pop of blank rounds. But the actual gun battles were few and far between. Most days they simply marched. The lower the temperature fell, the louder the snow crunched under their boots. The worst sound you can hear, Sergeant First Class Stephen Bauer said. When the temperature plunged below minus 30, the soldiers said they could feel a cold ache in their lungs. Exposed skin prickled and turned red in seconds. At minus 40 and below, the soldiers retreated to their tents and shifted into survival mode. Sergeants had to force their reluctant troops to keep drinking water. No one wanted to leave their tent to pee. On day 5, heavy snows forced a 6-hour pause so that the Army could plow the roads leading into and out of the training area. A dozen of the Able Company soldiers grabbed their weapons and strapped on their skis so they could practice being pulled by a snowmobile. The tactic, known as ski-joring, was supposed to help them move faster while carrying a heavy load. But many of the troops were still wobbly on the snow. The snowmobile made a big circle, pulling 5 soldiers who clung to a rope. On one of the passes, SPC Zarian Caldwell's M240 machine gun barrel caught in snow, sending him flying and taking out several soldiers behind him. Everyone was laughing and smiling. The Arctic is a hell of a place, said Sergeant John Wolfe, 26, of Selma, Alabama. An hour later, the pause was lifted. Able Company returned to the endless march. A big question that hung over the entire Arctic training exercise, now in its 5th year, was whether the U.S. Army could really fight a war this way. One problem was the warm tents, which stood out in the extreme cold and could be easily spotted by drones carrying thermal sensors. They glow like Christmas trees, said Sergeant Marcus Soto Simmons, one of the Able Company drone operators. A few days into the training center battle, Bo launched a surveillance drone and, using its thermal sensor, quickly found an enemy platoon in its tents. He then sent out a second killer drone carrying a mock explosive. The opposition soldiers heard its whirring engine as it sped toward them at 80 miles per hour and tried to scramble out of their tents to safety. But it was too late. The judges overseeing the exercise concluded that Bo had killed most of the enemy platoon. What would happen if drones took out a string of American tents, Bo wondered. How would the American people react? How would he? Senior Army leaders were looking for tent fabrics that radiated less heat. The Army was realizing that it needed more Arctic vehicles, too, like snowmobiles or big tracked troop carriers. The Swedish-made machines cost $1 million each, carry a dozen soldiers, and can move swiftly through deep snow. The exercise also showed the value of Arctic experience. The Canadians had weighed every piece of equipment that they brought to Alaska and meticulously planned how far their troops would be able to move each day. The American technique is go, go, go until you can't anymore, Brawley said. The Canadian approach, he concluded, was more effective. By the 9th day of the exercise, the U.S. and Canadian troops under Brawley's command had cut the opposition's supply lines. They were running low on fuel. You had the enemy in checkmate, one of the Army officers overseeing the exercise texted him. For the Able Company soldiers, though, the combat never felt as real as the cold. A handful of soldiers were forced out of the exercise by cold weather injuries, twisted knees, broken ribs, or wrenched backs. But the vast majority endured and were now taking turns digging out spots for their tents. Most preferred shoveling, which got their blood pumping and warmed their bodies, to standing around. They struggled to hammer tent stakes into permafrost. The smell of smoke from metal pounding metal hung in the air. 2 hours passed before they raised a tent. SPC Abdul Mayer, 25, who has immigrated from the Ivory Coast, threaded the Yukon stove's metal chimney through a hole in the canvas. I don't like the cold, he said, but here I am. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries today. The pugnacious media mogul who founded CNN, Ted Turner, 1938 to 2026. Ted Turner made television news a pervasive presence. Before he started the first 24-hour cable news channel, the Cable News Network, in 1980, Americans got their news from three major networks, 6:30 p.m. broadcast. By 7 p.m., Turner said, the news was over. CNN upended that model, and it was just one of Turner's achievements. He built the Atlanta-based Turner Broadcasting System into a juggernaut, incorporating seven cable networks. A ferocious competitor, he owned three sports teams, including the Atlanta Braves, and skippered his yacht to win the 1977 America's Cup. Along the way, he piled up billions of dollars, but later gave much of it to charity and bought and conserved nearly 2 million acres of wildland. Turner did none of this quietly. Headstrong and an incorrigible womanizer whose three wives included actress Jane Fonda, the mouth of the South, challenged rival Rupert Murdoch to a fistfight, called Christianity a religion for losers, and compared himself to Winston Churchill and Alexander the Great. If I only had a little humility, he once said, I'd be perfect. Raised in Savannah, Georgia, Robert Edward Turner III was shaped by his complicated relationship with his father, an abusive drunk who ran a billboard company, said the Wall Street Journal. Turner both feared him and sought his approval. After military school, he attended Brown University, but he was suspended for bedding a woman in his dorm room. He left Brown and returned to work for his dad. When the elder Turner shot himself dead in the bathtub, Turner inherited the business at 24. He buried his shock and grief in work, said CNN.com. He bought up radio stations, then a struggling Atlanta TV station. He turned it around by acquiring the rights to Braves games. And as it became profitable, he started to think bigger. Beaming the TV signal up to a satellite, he created what became TBS, cable TV's first superstation, reaching 2 million subscribers with a lineup of sports, movies, and sitcoms. Turner's move into 24-hour news was seen as a major gamble, said the Washington Post, and CNN, which went live on June 1, 1980, had a rocky start. Initially laughed off due to its low-budget look and technical snafus, it bled tens of millions of dollars in its first 5 years. But gradually, it upended the way news was consumed, riveting audiences by covering stories such as the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall as they unfolded. CNN's fortunes took a leap during the 1991 Gulf War, said the Associated Press. While most TV journalists fled Baghdad, CNN correspondents stayed put and captured vivid scenes, including anti-aircraft tracers lighting up the sky and reporters flinching from the concussion of bombs. CNN's coverage won a Peabody Award, and in 1991, Turner was named Time's Man of the Year. As he notched business wins, Turner earned a reputation for philandering, drunkenness, and public misconduct, said the New York Times. His marriages were rocked by open displays of infidelity, and he further tarnished his image by uttering ethnic and racial slurs. But he could nonetheless be a man of great charm. Fonda, his wife from 1991 to 2001, called him a 3D stereophonic Shakespearean-level sound and light show, and the public saw him as a lovable rogue. Turner continued to expand TBS, buying the Hanna-Barbera catalog and the MGM film library to create the Cartoon Network and Turner Classic Movies. But by the mid-1990s, he appeared to have reached the limit of his empire-building ambitions. In a movie he later termed a terrible mistake, he sold TBS to Time Warner, giving up an operational role. When Time Warner made what would prove a disastrous merger with AOL in 2001, he resigned amid reports he'd been forced aside, said NBCNews.com. That effectively marked the end of his reign as a media industry chief. In the ensuing years, Turner threw himself into philanthropy and conservation, said the Telegraph. He donated $1 billion to UN charities and supported a range of environmental initiatives. Buying land in a dozen states, he acquired the nation's largest herd of bison and started the bison-focused chain Ted's Montana Grill. In 2018, Turner revealed that he had Lewy body dementia, a degenerative brain disorder. Despite his regrets over the Time Warner debacle, he looked back fondly on a career he said was guided less by a profit motive than a spirit of adventure. "Hardly anybody wins all the time," he said in 2008. "I've won more than most." And with just a few seconds left, we'll hit the poll watch. 50% of adults under 50 say they get their health and wellness information from podcast and social media influencers on sites such as TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. 59% of health influencers identify themselves as coaches or entrepreneurs. And we'll finish out with a quote from Rebecca Solnit, who says, "Hope is not a lottery ticket you can sit on the sofa and clutch, feeling lucky. It is an axe you break down doors with in an emergency." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.